Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
There's music.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is a perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life there's no surrender, and there's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through. We are the ones who will never be broken. Our final breath, we'll fight to the death. We are soldiers, we are soldiers.
But thank you for coming to Bard's Logic Political Talk, part of the Growing Conservative Conversation, and also part of the Patriot Journalist Network. And tonight we have a special guest on this evening, and that special guest is the Constitution Party's vice presidential candidate, Jim Clymer. And tonight we will be interviewing him this evening. And we have on the line right now our panel of Chris and also Rex from the Rex, our Tex and Rex show. And I believe we already have our special guest on this evening, Mr. Jim Clymer. So without further ado, I will be opening up his mic and say, hello, Mr. Clymer. How are you this evening? Am I pronouncing that right?
You got it right. That's right. Thank you. Jim Clymer. Jim's just fine. I'm happy to be on your show this evening.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. And how are you doing this evening?
Well, pretty well. I may warn you in advance here. I seem to be having a little trouble with my phone. If it cuts out on me, I'll have to get on my cell phone, but I'm working off the landline for now, so we'll hope that holds up.
Well, we totally understand, of course, and once I see your line back in, I'll immediately let you in. And we know your time is precious, so we will go ahead and moving to the first part of the interview. In which, if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and your start in politics, and what has led you to being the VP nominee of the Constitution Party?
Did we lose him?
Nope, I still see him there. Yes, Mr. Clymer.
Uh-oh.
Yeah,
well,
I still
Chris,
see him on the...
Well, maybe there's a malfunction you mentioned. So, Chris, why don't you tell us a little bit about Mr. Clymer's history, since you have been kind of catching up on him today.
Okay, hold on. I'm sorry. Well, okay. So, basically, he was born and raised in Pennsylvania, and he became an attorney in that state. And then he actually ran on the Libertarian ticket initially, and for some state houses and things, you know, state positions and things like that. And then somewhere along the line, and that's kind of what the idea of interviewing him was he moved over to the Constitution Party, and he was actually the chairman of the party for 12 years. So this is the guy to talk to about the party. Go ahead, Robert.
And I'm actually going to bring in his mic. I believe he called back on his other line. So,
yes.
Mr. Clymer, welcome back.
Yes, I'm sorry. It looks like
no need to apologize.
We had some heavy rains here today, and it seems like it cut out on me again. So I guess I'll stay on my cell phone here and hope you can hear me okay. Is it coming through okay?
Yes, we can hear you fine. Thank you.
Okay,
great,
starting to ask me something, and I'm not sure where you were going.
No problem. No, just as a sort of an introduction, if you could tell us a bit about yourself, your start in politics, and what has led you to being the VP nominee of the Constitution Party.
Okay. I'll try to keep it brief and convention here. I really got involved with Howard Phillips, who's the founder of the Constitution Party. It initially started as the U.S. Taxpayers Party back in 1992, and I was one of those founding members with Howard and others who formed the party. I've had an interest in politics pretty much all of my adult life. I guess I'm going to tell you how be showing my age, but the first campaign I got involved with was the Goldwater campaign back in 1964 when I was actually a senior in high school at that time. My interest continued in mostly in the Republican Party up until I left in 1992 to, as I said, to join with Howard and his formation of then the U.S. Taxpayers Party. In 1999, we changed the party name to Constitution Party, and that was also the year I was elected national chairman, and I served in that role for 12 and a half years until this past April when, after finishing my third term, I decided it was time to let somebody else do it, and so I did not run for re-election. I've always had a motivation, a driving force, I guess you would say, to uphold the ideals of the U.S. Constitution. And I firmly believe that without a pulsar, without a something like the Constitution, which to be provide a firm foundation for our public policy, for our jurisprudence, we will be adrift as a nation. And I think that's what we've seen happening, where the nation has become gone adrift with many different competing philosophies and ideologies creeping in with other people, from other people who have a different worldview than Americans traditionally have. And are taking us down a dangerous path, in my view, and it's my goal and my hope to bring it back. And I guess the other part of your question was how I became the vice presidential nominee, and Virgil Goode, whom I understand you had on your show, was it just last night or just very recently anyway, became affiliated with the Constitution Party, and for the past three and a half years or so, I think somewhere around late 2008 or early 2009 is when he joined started affiliating with the Constitution Party. And I was, as national chairman, was promoting him to be our presidential nominee. And through that process, and when I bowed out as chairman, as party chairman, I was hoping to have a little more time for hunting and cutting wood and doing some of the other things I'd like to do. And my wife says I jumped from the frying pan into the fire. So when, for a few months here anyway, I'm going to be busier than I ever was. And because Virgil asked me shortly before he was nominated, he asked me if I would serve as his running mate for vice president. And that's the sort of thing you, you just can't say no to, I guess. So here I am.
Well, understood. And one thing I see is, why did you leave? You were part of the Libertarian Party for a time, and then you left them to join the Constitution Party. You know, could you tell us some reasoning behind the exodus from that party?
Well, yeah, that was really back in 1992 when we failed to get on the ballot for the U.S. Taxpayers Party at that time. Pennsylvania was very difficult to get on, and we that was our first time in trying that sort of thing, and we didn't get enough signatures to get on the ballot. And the Libertarian Party had a little bit of a problem. They had somebody who was running for Auditor General, which is an elected officer and statewide office in Pennsylvania, who, for one reason or another, had to bow out. She was one that was on their nominating papers and was nominated by the party for that office, but she had to bow out, and they were looking for a replacement. And they approached me if I would agree to do it. So I did. I accepted that. I ran for Auditor General. We also had another person, John Terry, who was pretty much part of us, but the Libertarians recruited him to be the U.S. Senate candidate. So we sort of ran as a pair that year. Libertarians in name, but our beliefs weren't any different than what they had been before or what they are now. But so I was, I did register as a Libertarian Party for a period of time there, but the problem I had with the Libertarian Party, and I still have a lot of friends in the Libertarian Party, there's much of what they believe, or there's a fair amount of what they believe that I think overlaps with what the platform of the Constitution Party, but there are some fundamental differences. And one of those differences, quite frankly, is the source of our law. And in the Constitution Party, and me personally, I will say that I believe that the foundation of our jurisprudence for the United States and as recognized in the Constitution, our founding documents, is that the ultimate source of law is God, and that it's the law as given by God is the ultimate source of law, and our purpose in government and civil society is to try to find that perfect law. It's referred to as natural law in the Declaration of Independence and many of our founders, whereas the Libertarian Party has a more of a secular philosophy and the belief that there's that there can be some just sort of the mind of man, I guess, is the closest way I could describe it, as being the source and reason as being the basis of our jurisprudence. And so that's where the underlying difference in ideology is. So while I was nominally a Libertarian, I never adopted that basic tenet of their ideology.
Okay. I definitely see that. I definitely see the difference, especially when some of the things we've heard come from, some of the other Libertarian candidates, which that's something that we'll touch on a different show. But I have here that, and I see you were a chairman for the Constitution Party for a while as well. And if you could tell us about your tenure there and what you accomplished while you were the chairman, and what your vision for the party in the future is?
Well, maybe I take that last one first. My vision for the party
sure.
is to see it become a dominant force in the political landscape of our country, and that the ideals and principles, the platform, the Constitution be made the public policy of our government. And another way of saying that would be to say that we get back to the Constitution, follow the purpose and intents of the Constitution, which we've strayed from so far. That's my vision. I will emphasize it. This is a political party. This is not intended to be a discussion group or something to make us feel good, or a venting session or a venting group or that kind of thing. It's a political party, and so our goal is to elect people to office and by electing people to office, by running campaigns, electing people to office, that we actually get to shape our public policy and of our government. So that's the goal. That's the vision. Now, what I accomplished during my 12 and a half years plus at the head of the Constitution Party, maybe a little harder to put a finger on. I mean, we went through some significant growing pains during that time. And, you become a victim of success to a certain extent. And as we became more successful, as we saw the party mature, let me back up just a little bit. In the early stages of our party, I must say that I felt a little bit like David felt when he was out fleeing from Saul in the wilderness, and the Bible says that all those who were in debt and those who were despondent and those who were in despair came to him. And that's a little bit the way I felt about the people that came to the U.S. Taxpayers Party, the Constitution Party. They're people who were in trouble one way or another, and they're looking for a party of refuge, if you will. But I saw the people mature over the years, and we attracted more and better people, and while we didn't win any major offices, we still we got better candidates. We had people running better campaigns and making a greater impact, and of course we did elect one state representative in Montana, served a couple terms there. So we had some successes, but with that we faced some new challenges, and we had we're made up of a lot of strong-willed people who believe very firmly and very fervently in the foundation of their beliefs, and consequently you have people that want to go one direction, other people want to go another direction. So we had some of those things we had to work through over the years, and so what I think we did do, though, was build a solid base, and we attracted some great leaders, and I think the party's in good hands. The leadership is in good, made up of good people now who are ready to take it on to the next level, and that's what I trust we'll do. And there are different ways of measuring success, and we automate the successes to be able to win, as I said earlier, and directly affect public policy in that way. But you can affect public policy just by getting the issues out there and running a good campaign. And I've run several of them here in Pennsylvania, as you seem to have done your research on me here. So, I mean, I ran for lieutenant governor twice. In 1994.
Right, we try to be thorough. we definitely try to be thorough. And one thing you touched on that I think is very relevant today is you said people are looking for refuge. I think a lot of folks are also looking for a party of principle that they're not finding with either the Democrat or the Republican Party.
That is so true. That is so true. And you know, there's a lot of people have the feeling, and correctly, I believe, that the Republican Party puts out a good-sounding platform and tries to appeal to people with its platform. But they have candidates and office holders who have no intention, have no compunction with straying from that platform. And you probably remember well 1996 when, after Bob Dole was nominated for the presidency, and somebody asked him about the platform that the Republicans had adopted, and he said, "I didn't read it, and I don't feel compelled to follow it." And that's, you know, he expressed that attitude, and that's the attitude I think a lot of them have. Now, thankfully, there are some good ones that are emerging now as part of the Tea Party effort and so on. And I wish them well. I don't think their strategy is going to work. I think just like we saw with Ron Paul, the Republican leadership will do whatever it takes to keep anybody who truly believes in the Constitution from getting too far. And,
I'm glad. Not to interrupt, but I'm glad you mentioned platform. And at that point, what I'd like to do, Mr. Clymer, is bring in Chris, who I think that's one of the things he'd like to bring up or ask about is the platform, among other questions, of course. That's going to be for him. And so at this time, if we move over to Chris and what he's got for you this evening. Chris, are you there and ready to roll?
You betcha. Yes, sir. I am. How are you doing this evening, sir?
I'm doing fine, thanks. How are you?
Great. I have a series of questions I put together. I've spent quite a bit of time with Floyd, your vice chair of Idaho, and he's on. We have a kind of a working Facebook group that is investigating third parties and doing the research, and it's been a great journey. And he kind of had, you know, he came on with Paul, your chair of Idaho, and then helped get his Virgil good last night. So this has been a great run. And through that process, I figured you were the guy, because you were chair for 12 years, to ask, you know, the party questions and some of those things, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely. I'll do my best.
I'm just listening to you for 10 minutes. You're the man, I can tell. How long, before we get started, how long do you have so I know how to compress, you know, and add or leave off questions and to be efficient for the listeners?
Well, I was told it'd be an hour.
Thank you.
I'm not saying it has to be cut off at that point, but I guess I'd like to keep it in. By the time an hour is, well, I'm done talking for an hour. I'm talked out pretty well.
We'll keep you fired up. I promise you.
Okay.
Okay. So let me. Well, these are all. I believe these are questions that you're going to be a natural at. I really do. First question, and we're not going to get into party platform because people can go to the website and they can read it. I more want to get into specifics. One thing before I get into the Q&A on that, one thing that our listeners would like to get a little better feel for is the foreign policy thing. So to make it simple, I'll just read you my question, and then you can roll with that. Can you clarify the foreign policy position more in depth? Of course, we had Virgil Goode on last night. But we have, you know, 900-some bases around the world. We're policing the world. The president is using the War Powers Act to play politics. People are getting killed with drones. And most of our listeners get that. We understand that it's a mess out there, and we're not happy with it. So I'm looking for more of the details behind the plans to untangle us from the world, because I know that's, you know, that's on your platform, and Virgil Goode explained that last night. But, you know, and untangling can also leave holes and confusion. We have allies out there. We have, you know, corporate investments in companies. We have an ally like Israel. And if we move out of some places too fast, we're going to leave some pretty big vacuums that are going to be filled by people we may not want them filled by. So I guess we're looking for that balance between, you know, what is the platform in terms of what would Virgil Goode do in the presidency to make sure we just don't come home and turn the world into a massive, you know, flame. To you, sir.
Yeah, a good question, and no easy answer to that. I mean, it's easy to say things like just bring them all home right now and things like that. The reality is that, and I use the example in Iraq, of course they supposedly were winding down there now, but in 2004 when I was running for the U.S. Senate, that question came up. You know, well, you know, we got into it, in my view, for the wrong reasons and the wrong way. First of all, there was no declared war. Is the president, the Congress, abdicating its responsibility by giving the president a blank check to do what he thought was necessary militarily? That's the wrong way. It's not the constitutional way of doing things. And that's where we get into conflicts that we shouldn't be getting involved in. Typically, it's where we get into conflicts that become sticky and protracted and so on. But once you're there, and once you've gone in and upset the balance of power and so on, to just precipitously leave, you probably, as you suggested in your question, making things, you know, compounding the error. And so I think we have to be circumspect about things like that, as well as our bases around the world. I think that we should have a policy of drawing in and closing them down. And there are places around the world that we're stationed. We have bases that I frankly don't think that there's any reason for them to be there anymore whatsoever. And I think it's about looking at them case by case and deciding whether it's just because we want to have a presence there in the world, or whether and what would be the ramifications of pulling out. And there's some places where I think we could pull out immediately, and there's some places where we would need to have a bit more of a deliberate withdrawal,
right,
and so on. So I
right.
think
now,
there is that
I'm
balance.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
How that's okay, I'm sorry. How do you guys view Israel, our relationship with Israel?
Well, and this may be controversial, but, you know, we're the friend of liberty everywhere, but the protector of ours alone is sort of
right.
my philosophy. And I don't subscribe to what is pretty much predominant view in the evangelical circles that Israel has a special place, in that we have to show them deference, show that nation deference, just because it's Israel. You know,
right.
I think that we treat it as a friend and ally, and certainly it has a right to exist in the world, and that right should be protected. But to what extent we need to have the obligation to protect it, I have some serious questions about that. And that's probably,
right.
I mean, born out of some of my religious views as well about that. So, I mean, I don't,
right.
Put it this way, I try to let my religious views affect my foreign policy.
Exactly. Yeah, and we could get off on that conversation. I think you and I probably have some similar thoughts on that. So, but let's roll on, otherwise we'll be there all night and you'll be really tired when I'm done. So tell us about the importance of ballot access. It's something that I've had the discussion with Floyd over and over and over again about being a real party and having ballot access. And then if you can cue in on Pennsylvania, because that's a hot issue that you guys are dealing with. Can you help us with that?
Yeah, I sure can. And that has been one of the challenges that we've had. And without, first of all, it takes a tremendous amount of money. It helps to have a good volunteer base. But the most important ingredient is money. You know, Americans elect. If you're familiar with what they were doing, they got on qualified for some of the most difficult ballots: Texas, California, Oklahoma, and some of the states. And they spent millions and millions of dollars in doing that. Now, they didn't have the volunteer base, and we have a volunteer base to help us out. But just generally speaking, the ballot access laws are just grossly unfair and prejudicial against independent or third-party candidates. And it varies widely from state to state. Some states fairly easy to get on. Some it's just about impossible. And so our success in getting on the ballot has risen or fallen largely with how much money we had and whether we had some large benefactors who helped with that process. And in years where we did have some who were able to put in several hundred thousand, we were never able to get into the millions of dollars, but where we did have in different years people that would put in several hundred thousand, and that helped us to get ballot access. I think our high water mark was about 43 states, and otherwise it's varied. So, and this year, quite candidly, we don't have such a benefactor. And Virgil Gooch put in some of his own money, and I put in some of my own money, and so on. But we just don't have that person who can put in several hundred thousand to get us over the top of the number of marginal states. But Pennsylvania is a good story for how bad ballot access can be. First of all, in terms of the number of signatures required, it's probably it's at least in the top quarter of the states in terms of difficulty. It varies from election to election depending on the votes from the past election, but this year our threshold number was 20,601, to be exact, was the number of votes we had to get on for a statewide race, including the presidency, and we turned in 35,000. The Libertarians turned in 49,000,
right.
And you would think that should be ample, but Pennsylvania has a provision where private parties can challenge your signatures. So what happens is when you turn them in, the state goes through, the state Bureau of Elections goes through and makes sure that they are pro forma correct, but does not check them for the validity of registrations and things like that. It makes sure the blanks are all filled in, makes sure that it's in proper form, that they're notarized correctly, and so on, and that you have what appears to be enough to get over that threshold. Well, as I'm sure you know, we were challenged by the Republicans, and as were the Libertarians also. Somehow the Greens, who got the least of the three parties, the fewest number of signatures, were not challenged at all, but we and the Libertarians were. And we went through a grueling process where, I don't know how to describe it, but we had to have, the court order said we had to have 20 people to appear daily until the process was completed to duke it out on these signatures. So we had 20 people that went down to Philadelphia, and we were there to try to go over these signatures line by line, these challenge signatures, and whatever the objection may be, the objection may have been it wasn't legible, that they weren't registered at the address where they put on the petition, that the date wasn't filled in correctly, or looks like somebody else helped them with the with filling in the information. And we've got some rather arcane rules that have developed some bad court decisions here too, that says that, you know, they have to fill in all the information themselves. You can't It's not just a matter of getting their signature and putting in the rest of the information. They have to put in their address. They have to print their name. They have to they have to put in the date. And if you help them with that, it can be invalidated. And then to make matters worse, Pennsylvania has a provision in the election code that if a challenger is successful in challenging your petitions, you can pay their be required to pay their attorney's fees and costs for bringing that challenge. And that has happened. It's happened numerous times, but notably, Ralph Nader got hit with over $75,000 in costs that way. And then a couple years later,
sure,
a Green Party Senate candidate, Romanelli, got hit with $86,000 penalty. So,
does that mean that you guys are out of Pennsylvania? Is it still in process?
Well, we are out.
Okay.
They gave us an ultimatum after the second day. They gave us an ultimatum that if we didn't bow out, they were going to ask for attorney's fees, and basically we were, and they were well over $100,000, and it looked like it was going to be nip and tuck at that point. We didn't have, and we weren't at all sure. I mean, we were working people. We weren't at all sure that we could continue to. In fact, we knew we couldn't keep 20 people down there to carry on this process of. And so, under that kind of pressure, under that kind of threat, we bowed out. And now the Libertarians are still fighting here. More than 3 weeks later, they're still. It looks like they might be able to eke it out. But again, they had 14,000 more signatures than we had to begin with, so they had a wider margin. But and they had, I guess, Gary Johnson's campaign money available, but they have more resources than we do. So I wish them well, but
it's a tough game with the RNC. Cool, that's awesome. So. I know that, tell us what changes the party is making to attract more voters. You know, you're dealing with some of the most dynamic events out there, the youth voters, the Ron Paul people, the Tea Party people, minorities, women. You know, I know that you have visions and you guys have conversations behind the scenes, and to grow a party, those are key areas.
Yeah, and I guess we're still struggling to find ways to get the message out. One way is certainly by running good campaigns, and you know we found that because it either takes a tremendous amount of money to get the publicity, to get the coverage you need, or it takes a good campaign can help to do that. And you know we have several good campaigns. Particularly, we have a lieutenant governor candidate in Missouri who's running an excellent campaign. I think Virgil Goode, in large part because he's popular in Virginia, where he served for 12 years in the Congress, and Virginia being one of the crucial swing states that they're looking at, he's getting a lot of national media exposure. Just because of being in that position, but it also gives an opportunity for people to hear about the Constitution Party, what it stands for, and we've tried to do it in a multifaceted way. We've been pushing to get people to not just look at the statewide races, the glamour races, if you will, but to be active in their local communities, to be volunteers in their local communities, and to run for school board, for county commissioner, for township supervisor, run for the local races and get yourself established, get yourself recognized as a valuable asset in the community at the local level, and instead of focusing solely on the, like I said, the more glamorous races. But you also have to have that. You still need to have a good presidential candidate. You still need to have good gubernatorial candidates and so on, because they will get, if they run a good campaign, they'll get exposure on a statewide basis or a national basis, as the case might be, and makes people aware of, helps to make people aware of what it stands for, and that's what attracts. I mean, that's really what happened to Ron Paul. Let's face it. He ran, of course, in 1988 as a libertarian, and got very little attention. But in his most recent two runs for the presidency, he just because he ran a good campaign nationally, he got a lot of exposure and he attracted a lot of people to him because they got to hear his message through his campaign, by and large.
Right. Let me shift on. That was awesome. Thank you, sir. Let me shift on you a little bit, and then we can come back to more of the structural questions on the party. But how do you view if Virgil Good walks into that door and you walk into that door and sit in that Oval Office, how do you view those first 30 days in terms of policies, changes, things like that? Can you give us kind of a dynamic plan that people can bite their teeth into to get a feeling of what you guys are going to do to make the changes that this party, represents?
Okay. And remember, I'm the vice presidential candidate, not the presidential candidate. And
sure.
You had Virgil Good on here before me, so I didn't get to hear that, so I don't know what all he might have said. I don't want to say anything that's contradictory to him, but I can tell you what my view would be. And,
sure, that's fine.
Biden does it all the time. I wouldn't worry too much about it.
Yeah, right. First of all, I would encourage him. I'm going to say this from the standpoint of me counseling President Good on what he should do and giving my two bits on what policies he should set. First thing I would urge him to do is to enter an executive order revoking every executive order entered by the Obama administration and probably some going back before beyond that. And start off with a policy that this is not going to be, that this is the executive branch, and you're not going to be trying to legislate out of the executive office, because that's obviously not what the Constitution stands for, and that there's going to be a new course signal, a strong signal that it's going to... it's not going to be business as usual, that we're going to weigh everything by the Constitution and make every attempt to follow the Constitution. I would like to see him immediately set out plans to abolish those departments that are not constitutionally authorized, or maybe some that you could argue are constitutionally authorized, but not wise use of resources. And I would certainly list the Department of Education at the top of that list. Frankly,
amen.
I don't know that we need to have a Department of Agriculture. And while that may be justified in the under the Commerce Clause, I think it's something the federal government should not be involved with, and how that's expanded. I'm saying this as a part-time farmer and as somebody who grew up on a farm, but we need certainly housing, urban development. I look at each of the departments and urge Congress to scale them back or get rid of them altogether if they're either not constitutional or not sound public policy. That would embark on that course right away. I would do the same thing with the military. And as we discussed before a bit, start examining immediately which bases can be closed around the world. And you know, we have people who are out of work. We have people that can't pay the taxes. We have a heavy tax burden and running outrageous deficits of, I think, $1.3 trillion this year, and we've got to find ways to cut, and that includes the military. And we for a proper defense, we can have a strong defense
right.
that's truly defensive of our citizens and our borders, without for a lot less than what we're spending now. And it's a matter
yeah.
of spending it wisely. So I guess those are some of the areas that I would. I would emphasize that we get started on right away.
Sure. No, that's beautiful. And Virgil Goode did cover some of the details on this, and I just wanted to get your perspective as the guy that would be behind the scenes with him. Here's a question, and this is, I do believe we asked Mr. Goode this too, is given that you're going to have a Congress that's going to fight everything you guys stand for. I mean, I'm not saying everybody in Congress, but, you know, I'm sure there's some good people in there that are waiting for a decent constitutional president and vice president to walk in the door so they can stand up and move that direction. But given that you're going to have a pretty uncooperative Congress, would you guys be willing to cut government where it's extra constitutional, or will you always seek Congress to do it? In other words, will you make those moves from that executive office, or are you going to work with Congress trying to get it done?
Well, I'm opposed to an imperial presidency, even if it's for good purpose. And I may differ with some other people here, but I think you get into that trap and say, well, you know, I don't like it when Obama goes around Congress and issues edicts and appoints czars and issues executive orders and doing things which are really the function of Congress if it should be done at all, and then we come in and we have the idea that we're going to do the same thing and we're going to do it for good purposes. I think we need to break that cycle. We need to. I would want to work with Congress. Now, it is the executive branch with an obligation to execute the laws that are, I mean, it's a constitutional duty of the president, or the president and his staff is to, and departments is to execute the laws of the country. And but it's Congress's duty to make them and also to rescind them. And the president can't unilaterally constitutionally abolish a department, for example. It'd be nice to do that, but that's assuming, again, the powers of the office, and it's unbecoming, it's unconstitutional, and so on. So somehow you've got to balance that. On the other hand, he takes an oath to uphold the Constitution, and if there's something that's come across his desk with is clearly unconstitutional, then I think he has a duty to not follow through with that. I mean, that's part of the he's got an oath of office to fulfill
right.
as well. You know, I don't think you carry that too extremely, but you when it comes down to it, it's a matter of doing what is right by the Constitution, even if Congress may be wrong. But again, the primary emphasis would be to whether it's bully pulpiting or whether it's cajoling or whatever it needs to be done to Congress for it to do its duty and to also follow the Constitution.
That is an awesome answer. You just fired a lot of people up. You really did, because that's one of the things that we've seen, and one of our arguments with the Patriot Act is that you come on board and, yeah, it was under a Republican and we feel all safe and fuzzy because we know it's George W. Bush, but what about the next guy that walks in and takes control of that and turns it into NDAA And the next thing we know, we're all suspect terrorists in our own country. I mean, I totally agree with that. That's an awesome answer. One last question before I pass it back to Robert is it's kind of a twofold thing, but it fits together. One, you know, obviously Virgil Good is a new gentleman in the party. And we've talked about this before. He didn't really answer it because I think he's too polite to. But how does he impact, you know, being that transitional candidate, how does he impact all the down ballot people you guys have around 15? I believe it's like 15 states. You have U.S. senators, House of Representatives, state senate, House. I have the list, and it's pretty impressive. How does he impact all that?
I don't know exactly without having a good feel for the different races, but I think he certainly helps, especially where he goes in and campaigns. I think he helps. I think he's got to help. I mean, he's a great spokesman for the principles and ideals of the party, and he knows how to relate to people, and it's got to help, is all I can say. Where if he goes in and campaigns in those areas, in those states where there are other candidates running, it's got to make it's got to be a help to the down races. And if I can digress just a little bit, tell you another war story. In 2004, I ran for U.S. Senate here in Pennsylvania against Arden Specter, the Rhino Republican, and Joe Huffle, the Democrat. And if I must say so myself, I ran a very good race. I was participating in debates. I was interviewed by newspapers and radios and so on, and I was frankly told that while they often accuse of ignoring third-party candidates, the reason is because they're not running real campaigns. But they could see that I was running a real campaign, and so they were treating me the same way they were treating the major parties, which I took as a real compliment. And I was even endorsed by a major newspaper, the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, which admittedly is a conservative newspaper for a big city newspaper, but still. But in the process, and of course we had a Constitutional Party candidate running for president that year, it was Michael Peruka, but George Bush was running for re-election also, and fevers were running high about the importance of re-electing George W. Bush, and I had a lot of people that were concerned that if the Constitutional Party was too strong, we were going to help to defeat Bush. And as a matter of fact, when I went to my voting place, my polling place that day, on election day to vote, I was getting in my car to leave, and there was a big long line waiting to get in to vote. And a lady came running out of the line, came running over to me, and she said, "Mr. Klein, I've got to ask you one question. Did you vote for George W. Bush?" And then she proceeded to tell me that if I did, she wasn't going to vote for me. She viewed that as such an important thing that if I didn't vote for Bush, that she wasn't going to vote for me. So I suppose mm-hmm. I lost the vote there. But
right.
So what I'm saying, I guess, is it can work two ways. In a case like there may be some down party races where they like that candidate and would vote for them, but they feel so strongly, so passionately about the ticket at the top that it can work against them sometimes as well.
Interesting. That's a great answer because, you know, and I've heard this before, you know, people get so caught up on the man on the top of the ticket that they lose their minds. You know, it's like American Idol all over again. I want to tell you, I really appreciate your time and allowing me to rapid fire on you, and I'm going to pass this back over to Robert. They have one good key question, and then he can figure out if you need to go or you want to answer questions or take calls. But I'm done, and I respect what you're doing, and I pray that this party does great things. I really like you guys, and I think that you're going to make an important play in politics here soon, especially with what we see going on with the DNC and the RNC. So back over to you,
great.
Robert. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Chris. I really appreciate it. And I've just got the one question to you, Mr. Clymer, is that we talk a lot about natural law on Bard's Logic here, and it brings itself up in interviews as well. Would you explain how the principles of natural law would be applied in governing of the executive branch if the Constitution Party was to obtain the presidency?
Yeah, boy, that's a good question. I may have to think about it a while to come up with a proper answer, but let me make a stab at it here. Now, first of all, as I said earlier in the show, I think natural law, or God's law, if you will, the law of nature, nature's God, as Jefferson described it in the Declaration of Independence, is what we recognize, and it's a bit of a philosophical, ideological recognition that there is God's law that supersedes all, and that we are ultimately answerable to his law. Now, I'm a lawyer. I don't presume to know all the law or have all the answers or to have a corner on the revelation, God's revelation of his law. But I will submit that it's a lifelong quest for me to try to learn that and define that. And I think that's what our founding fathers, the attitude they had as they drafted the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and then the Constitution, to try to make that law, to apply the principles of that law to mortal man. Now, let me carry that a little bit further. If you look at the common law of America, which I think every state follows except Louisiana, or had as its basis, if you look at the common law, that was very much built upon that principle that God's law is supreme, and that civil law is to try to find a way to make application of that law among mortal men. And whether you look at the laws for murder, for rape, for theft, whatever, under the common law, it was pretty much right out of the Bible. I mean, it was just, you can trace it back exactly. Now, as we've become much more civil law minded over the last number of decades, in the last century or so, I suppose, actually now, that we've modified, we've amended the common law in many ways and incorporated other cultural concepts into it, but the foundation of our law still points back to the law as given, as revealed in the Bible. And so in terms of as president of the executive officer, implementing that, I don't have any pat answer on how you do it in every case, in every situation. But I
sure,
think it's
sure.
more that understanding. It's that understanding of where the source of our law and our jurisprudence, and trying to find that and to follow that. The most practical application is the Constitution, because that's we don't take an oath of office to uphold natural law. We take an oath of office to uphold the Constitution, because that's where the specific guidelines are given, and our frame of reference is within the natural law, I guess is the way I would say it.
Okay, great. I know a lot of folks out there definitely would find some resonation with that. That's been where I just kind of popped that up. But at this time, I'd like to have Rex come in, and Rex has a few questions. And thank you very much for that answer, and I really do think it covered, a lot of basis. So that said, I will turn it over to Chris.
Okay. Mr. Clymer, I feel
not
like we're
Chris,
sitting around
Rex,
a,
I'm sorry, Rex.
Sorry, Robert. This is Rex, Mr. Clymer. I feel like we're sitting around a campfire learning about what America means. It's very comforting, and I'm so glad to know that you really share the founder's vision. I particularly liked your approach to the natural law question, which you just answered, in that it is, even though the Constitution is based on natural law, you said that you'll take an oath to uphold the Constitution. And I would like to just go a little deeper in that, because you mentioned earlier something about certain secularists have found the Libertarian Party more their home than the Constitution Party. And what would you say to somebody who may not share the fundamental basis of a Christian outlook or even a full grasp of natural law vis-a-vis why the Constitution Party would still be a defender of their liberties?
Well, I think that's the security of our system and the security of, quite frankly, of biblical law. And if I digress back to the children of Israel, you know, there were a lot of foreigners who came over and immigrated into the land of Israel because they saw the security of their system, even though they may not have adopted the Jewish faith. And I think the same thing is true of our Christian heritage here and our Christian jurisprudence, if you will. There is security and freedom that's offered by our form of government, by our Constitution, and it's for people of all faiths. Now, let me also just say that and I think this is where the libertarians have a fallacy, not to pick on them, but every legal system, every government, every country that has laws is going to have some foundation for its belief. You can't have a truly secular society. There's going to be some foundation. And this is a struggle I went through as a younger man, because I had very much a libertarian philosophy in my head, but I came to realize that it's just the only question is whose moral code are you going to adopt? You're going to adopt some moral code from somewhere. And I decided that I'm going to stop apologizing or questioning, and I'm going to accept the fact that our founders recognized the Judeo-Christian or simply the Christian understanding of law as the moral code that was adopted as for our jurisprudence. And that's when it was adopted. And we don't have to accept secular humanism or Eastern mysticism or some other moral code or some other religious foundation. Our country was founded on Christian principles, and that's the moral code that we've adopted, and I think we should be defending that in every respect. And so that's I wandered there, and I sort of lost your question in the process.
No, I think you actually answered it quite right. The question I was saying is, and it's something that I think that was levied against George Bush when he was president because of his openness about his evangelical faith, where people who may not subscribe to the Christian worldview feel that, you know, if America's founded by Christians and Christians are running it, that it's an alien place for other people, not having a differentiation between Christian philosophy and Christian faith, which is a personal journey. And I think you answered it, unless you feel that you need to expand on that a little bit more for people who might, you know, be more libertarian, materialistic in their outlook.
Yeah. Well, and I guess that is it. I think I did answer, but I had a Muslim friend one time, and not just a friend who happened to be a Muslim, a neighbor. And we had some discussions. I haven't had contact with him for a number of years now, but he had some discussions, and he said, I recognize that this is a Christian country and based on Christian principles, and I don't have any problem with that. He said, I appreciate the fact that I'm allowed to live here and worship as I please, without fear of persecution and so on. And I'm more than happy to acknowledge the Christian foundation of this country and allow you to keep that. Now, unfortunately, all Muslims don't believe that way.
Right.
But yeah. but there's ones who did and who recognized that and appreciated that. And you know, that is the safety that they can, people of any faith can enjoy. And I think our platform says that quite well.
I think it does, and I think that the inclusiveness is a great answer. But you mentioned one word where people of other faiths feel that they can live in a Christian-based culture like ours and not feel persecuted. And that kind of pivots into my next and final question. Given that both Mitt Romney and Barack Obama are pro-NDAA, which is basically the bill that negates, or I should say the law that negates the Bill of Rights, And the fact that they're both presidents recently have all used executive orders to operate extra-constitutionally, and I think we touched on this before, but I want to get a little more specific. Are you comfortable rescinding those executive orders as an executive? I know that you wouldn't be the president, you'd be the vice president, but as an executive, you know, reversing the extent of those executive orders rather than going through Congress, who may actually like them and just not want to admit to it, you know, things that have basically appropriate, you know, essentially given the president dictatorial powers.
Well, it's a good point because, in one sense, I'd be advocating what I said I didn't want to do. And, of course, the way executive orders work, and this is the way they get around the legislative function of an executive order, is president issues an executive order, and then Congress has, I think it's 90 days, it's either 60 or 90 days, something like that, where they can rescind it. They can legislatively do away with it. And if they don't act on it, then it becomes like law. And so you could argue on one hand that, well, all these executive orders were allowed to become law by Congress, by Congress's inaction. And so, therefore, to issue an executive order that rescinds all of those executive orders that were done by previous presidents, you're maybe acting extra-constitutionally, you're doing the very thing that you're accusing other people of doing. So,
right. And I understand it in principle, but I meant, in other words, reversing them as opposed to, you know, enacting new powers, just curtailing the powers that you shouldn't have as president and vice president based on the Constitution that you would, inheriting, you know, Barack Obama's dictatorship, in essentially.
Yeah.
Well, I don't mean to put you on the spot. I can ask you something easier, like, you know, what's in Area 51? I'm kidding.
I would like to know that too, Rex.
Tell me.
Back to you, Robert. Mr. Clymer, thank you so much for letting me answer, ask you those questions and for yanking your chain a little bit. We have to have a little bit of fun. If you don't laugh, sometimes you'll cry. Appreciate you being here.
Absolutely. My pleasure indeed. Thanks for what you guys are doing. I appreciate it.
No, thank you. Well, we're not going to hear about Area 51? No, I'm just joking. No, of course it is. But yes, thank you very much. And, of course, we would all love for you to be able to, you know, stay on for the whole show, but we understand how, you know, you're busy in the position that you're in. So I'd like to say once again, thank you very much for coming in. And, of course, we would all love to have you and Mr. Goode come in at another time, and other folks from the party as well, to talk about other tickets. Even if it's, you know, would just be local, such as sheriffs, because that's something that's of an interest as well. So, I mean, if you have a few more moments, I'm sure people would be great to ask you questions, but if not,
I could take another 5 to 10 minutes probably to see if any questions come in, sure.
Okay, great. Well, let me see what I've got here on the line, and then while I'm waiting for those folks, let's hear about Area 51. Okay, thank you. I can't help myself. Okay, well, we did have a caller I was waiting on. I guess they dropped the line. I believe that was Tex from the Tex and Rex show, but I no longer see a line here. So what I'll do is I will see if there's anything that Chris would have liked to have asked that was uncertain as to whether he would have had the time to do so. So, Chris, is there anything you'd like to add on? Great, thank you.
Yeah, the swing states that are up for grabs right now, can you talk about what's going on in those swing states and what Mr. Good's chances are, or your guys' chances, excuse me, of tipping the balance or winning those? That's a key question I had to skip over for time.
Okay. Well, Virginia, of course, I talked a little bit about that before, and you probably saw that in some of the polls he's polling as high as 9% statewide right already now. And that could easily make the difference in the state of Virginia. Pennsylvania, unfortunately, another swing state, although they pretty much have written off. Interesting. About the time we withdrew here in Pennsylvania, Romney seemed to throw in the towel on Pennsylvania, and they pulled millions of dollars of advertising that they had scheduled. They pulled, figuring that Pennsylvania is a lost cause, so they took that off the swing state list. But I think virtually every other swing state that they list were on the ballot. Ohio, of course, is one. Wisconsin, Colorado, Nevada, and Iowa, which I'm not sure if I'm on New Hampshire. Yeah, all those what they call pivotal swing states. And interesting, in Colorado, we're actually first on the ballot. And that's because Tom Tancredo ran as our gubernatorial candidate 2 years ago in Colorado. He made it, he thrust the party there into major party status. And so they got to be drawn along with the Democrats and Republicans and drew the top ballot spot. So we're actually first in the ballot there. And I don't know how much difference that makes, but it could make a significant difference and enough to swing the state one way or the other and for us to make a good showing. I think we'll have a good showing in Nevada. And I'm looking for good things in Ohio. I think we could make a good showing in Ohio. So I know the Republicans are very worried. The Romney camp is extremely worried about us. And
if I may interject, and I'm not the Mr. Clymer, and I appreciate coming to Ohio. And in my area where I live, it's very conservative. Well, not very, but it's pretty conservative. And I see a lot of the local candidates for the Republican, but I hardly see anything for Mitt Romney. I hardly see anything at all. So I think that's indicative of what you're saying about Ohio. But at this time, what I'd like to bring in is a gentleman that I believe everyone here on the line is familiar with, and I believe that this is Floyd, who is also of the Constitution Party there in Iowa. So I'm going to open up his mic, and 601, I do see you on the line, and if we have some time with Mr. Clymer, we will let you in on the call. But first, I know that Floyd has been on hold for quite some time, so I want to give deference to him. So go ahead, Floyd, is this you, 208? No.
No,
okay.
I thought you said you had a 601, Robert.
Oh, I apologize for that. I thought that I had that. Okay, well, 601, then I'm opening up the mic. Yeah,
all
601.
Right, thank you. Mr. Clymer, I was wondering if you could, I believe I read in an article online while you were at the Paul Fest and you were making your case to the Paul supporters that You had made reference to your position on the drug war being a little bit more libertarian. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that.
Well, let me say, first of all, I think the war, the federal war on drugs, is misguided. I don't think it's constitutional, and it wastes a lot of money and infringes. It becomes another excuse to take away a lot of people's rights. Much like the Patriot Act, they make them sound good, but so I'm opposed to. And here's where I probably am differing a bit from Mr. Good, but I'm generally opposed to the federal government being involved in the drug war and imposing criminal statutes on the state. I think it's a local issue, it's a state issue, and let me say I've never used, knowingly in any way, used any illegal drugs in my life. I'm not at all advocating the use of narcotics or, you know, illegal drugs of any kind. That's not where I'm coming from, but I am coming from a personal liberty standpoint and a personal accountability, and believe that, first of all, the emphasis should be on individual personal responsibility, and but secondly, allowing that decision to be made by states and local communities. I think that's where it should lie, rather than the federal government getting involved with it.
Right, right.
Did that answer your question?
That did. I really like that answer.
Thank you.
Well, great.
Hey,
thank you very much for calling in.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Chris.
Can I follow up with a question on that? We have a gentleman, Kelly Mordecai, who wrote a book called The Fourth Branch. He talks about a great book, and we're doing kind of an investigative series on state sovereignty, state authority, state sovereignty. And while you're talking about the states issue, can you give us, you know, obviously we all know that the federal government has encroached, you know, continually for the last several decades and taken over central power, which is what our founding fathers absolutely, you know, were afraid of and did not want to happen, but it has happened. And so we're doing this research and discussion on, you know, state sovereignty and how do we get that back. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, and I think the groundwork is being laid for taking back some of that. I mean, just the awareness of the 10th Amendment, what it means, and the emphasis that we're seeing on the 10th Amendment. Charles Keyes, former state representative in Oklahoma, of course, has done a lot of work on that and helped to make people aware of the 10th Amendment. So you know, I can remember not that many years ago where you mentioned the 10th Amendment and people's eyes would glaze over. They had no idea. There's still a lot of people that's probably true for, but there's a lot more people who are aware of it and recognize the fact that, and I like to say it this way, you know, the 10th Amendment is there to remind people that the federal government only has such powers as have been delegated to them by the states. And it's a way of saying, look, folks, if we didn't give you, the federal government, a particular power, you don't have it. The states have it. And remember that. And, you know, and again, just first of all, the awareness, the education, and then having people that have a backbone in state government. The constitutional sheriff's movement that Sheriff Mack is organizing and working on building up. You know, just the fact that the people recognize that the state officials recognize that their state power is sovereign and there are boundaries that the federal government can't cross, and being willing to stand up for that, I think, is a big step for that. The teaching of the understanding of interposition by state officials, by state authorities, that they have a duty, a constitutional duty, to interpose between their citizens, the citizens of their state, and an overreaching federal government. And, you know, you're seeing some signs of that, of people becoming aware of that, and hopefully we'll have state officials who take that seriously and willing to stand up and you know, make it happen.
Not to interject on that, but let me follow up on that with a key question. Do you find in your walk, in your political career, that a lot of the state governors and the people in the states are fighting back to say, hey, this has gone too far, we want our states our state sovereignty or authority back?
Well, I hear from some other states. I certainly don't see it in Pennsylvania, unfortunately. I don't see it here. In all honesty, I don't. Rick Perry in Texas gave a few grumblings. I'm not sure how serious he would be with when it came down to push and shove, but at least he fired a couple of shots across the bow, I think, to the federal government on a couple of different occasions. And so I think there are some signs that people are becoming aware of it around the country, but like I said, unfortunately not here in Pennsylvania.
That's awesome. Go ahead, Robert. Sorry.
I appreciate his time coming in, but he said he gave us about 10 minutes, and I believe he's given us 15. But I have one more caller. If you could take one more call, that's great. If not, I understand why you could not, because you did say you give us 10, and you've given us 15, which I know we all really appreciate that.
Take one more caller if it's on the line, then if we can cut it off at that point, that would be great.
Yeah,
great.
Awesome.
I really appreciate it, and I'm sure the person who was on 304 appreciates it as well. So 304, I'm going to open up your mic, and if you can give a short question for Mr. Clymer, that would appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Hello, this is Dally. I was just wondering if you could tell me how you feel about the fair tax.
You know, I dabbled with the fair tax, and one view, I would say, or one part of me says that anything is better than the income tax. I mean, no matter if you're gonna rank taxes for their badness or their how onerous they are, certainly the income tax is one of the worst. And I believe that if you're going to have a tax, a consumption tax is better than an income tax, rather than taxing somebody's productivity and the fruits of their labor. But I see a lot of problems with the fair tax. I see it giving the federal government a lot more power to, interject itself in transactions and just a way of tracking everything that happens, every aspect of commerce, and I recoil against that. And I still believe that the best tax is the way the founding fathers set it up. You know, this imposts duties, tariffs, and selected excise taxes and things of that nature. And if that's not enough, if that's not enough to run the legitimate functions of government, then let the states individually collect taxes in whatever way their citizens will allow them to, and let each state contribute based on the population. Let them contribute. Because in the very real sense, the benefits we get from the federal government are shared equally by all people, and everybody per capita basis should bear the burden of whatever benefit we get from the federal government, and that's the principle that I think is the best.
Awesome.
Yeah, great. And I appreciate it very much for you coming in and taking that last question. So, in closing, I'd just like to, of course, say thank you very much once again for coming in to speak with us. And what I'd like to do at this time, just briefly, for both Chris and Rex, if you'd like to just say some parting words to Mr. Clymer, we'll let him go on his way. Thank you very much. And go ahead. We'll go with Chris and then Rex, and then we'll close out the talk.
Sir, I want to thank you for taking your time to come to our show and give us of your wealth of knowledge. There's never enough time to have a conversation with somebody like you. You have a lot of depth of wisdom, and that's something that we're missing in this country, is that depth of wisdom and that conviction of character and understanding the importance of the Constitution. Your discussion on the Constitution and the natural law was so important, and it does not get talked about enough. People don't understand it. And talking about, why other religions and no religions, why everybody has the rights in this country, you know, grows up from the fact that of those Judeo-Christian, you know, principles that are embedded in that, in the founding of this country, in the Constitution. And that was a breath of fresh air. I really appreciate that. And I appreciate your time here. I really do. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you.
Well, I just want to echo. I want to echo that, Mr. Clymer. Thank you for giving us the extra time, and it's really appreciated. And we appreciate your strong stance for the Constitution. I would love to ask you questions for another 8 hours, but we don't have that kind of time. But I appreciate you being here, and I wish you well on the trail to restore sanity to the United States. Thank you.
Hey, well, thank you. And I'd be happy to get back on your show another time sometime. So.
Oh, that'd be wonderful.
That would be great. We'd appreciate that.
Okay.
Have a good night, sir.
Good luck to you, sir, and take care.
All right. Thanks again to all of you, and God's blessing to you. We'll see you.
Thank you, sir.
See you. Thank you. Good night. Okay, folks, that was, of course, the Constitution Party's vice presidential candidate, Jim Clymer. And what I'd like to do now is, if there's anyone who'd like to call in on the discussion, at area code 347-945-7428, you are more than welcome to do so, or if you could just, or would like to just, participate in the chat, that is fine as well. So until we're waiting for someone to do so, if we'll go with Rex, give you what your thoughts are, and then we'll go to Chris, and then we'll go from some callers. So go ahead, Rex.
Well, the first thing I have to say is that I'm extremely disappointed that we didn't get into that Area 51 question because, you know, I mean, I'm a card-carrying, tinfoil hat-wearing conspiracy theorist, and I know that that's where they keep the good stuff, and I want to know what the aliens really look like. I mean, is Barack Obama really an alien? Is Mitt Romney really an alien? Because we know Mitt Romney claims to be an alien from Kolob, and Barack Obama claims to be an alien from Kenya. But no, I'm kidding. I think that Mr. Clymer was extremely forthright and answered the questions very well. And like I told everybody, I could go on for hours. It's wonderful that both Mr. Goode and Mr. Clymer have given us as much time as they did. But it's amazing to me when you really get to do this how little an hour is, and it really kind of tells you how terrible soundbite TV news reporting is, because you can't get information. We managed to go very broad, and I would like to go very deep on a lot of issues with both of them, but unfortunately, if you do that, you're going to end up with an hour show on one topic, and we got so much to cover. And I think that in the last 2 days, given the 2 hours that they were here, we really got a feel for who these men are and how they view the Constitution. I thought today's discussion vis-a-vis natural law and Christian culture and the origins of the Constitution was very powerful. And I think that there's no doubt about it that the Constitution Party, which has been around since 1992, that has significant amounts of representatives in state and federal government, is definitely a player in this year's elections, principally because the mask is off the Republican Party, and they've clearly indicated to us that they are just the right wing of the single party that we have in these United States. And I think these guys are definitely capable of playing a significant role in restoration, and as are, you know, the Libertarian Party and even Ron Paul himself, who is essentially still a write-in candidate who has a pretty good chance of winning in 8 states. Thank you, Robert.
Oh, you're welcome, Chris. I mean, I don't know why I keep calling you Chris, Rex. I don't know what
well,
that
you
is.
Well, you know, me and, I mean, the fact is that Tex and Chris sound a lot alike. Or is
yeah,
it Rex
that's
and Chris?
What it is. That's
it's
exactly
Rex and Chris.
What that is.
Just as long as that guy Dan doesn't call in.
I'll really get confused then. No, I don't know what it is. But go ahead, Chris.
Well, I think the reason you're having troubles between the three of us is we're all troglodytes, and I've posted that video on my site so people
my
know
gosh,
what a troglodyte
wow.
is. Anyway, I it's just a breath of fresh air. And you know, to echo, boom, you know, what Rex said and what Mr. Clymer said and what Mr. Good said. And I do want to say something because I finally got a chance. When you're doing the interview and you're in depth, you're not, and I'm chatting between you guys, I'm not on the outside chat, and I took a little break and I'm reading the messages. Here's the thing to understand for you guys and gals on the outside. You know, it isn't very often you get a vice president, president candidate on a, you know, amateur blog talk radio environment. And so we're
who
doing
you
the
call
best
an
we
amateur?
Can. Okay, I'm sorry. But you know what I mean? We're doing the best. We're doing the best. Oh, God, here we go. But we're doing the best we can. And I build a Q&A doc on every one of these interviews. And I tell everybody to chime in, you know, put your questions down. Then we go through it and try to organize it, you know, so that we can be respectful of the person's time, ask relevant questions. You know, we could get into the details of, you know, how you're going to increase gold mining in Colorado. It just is not a viable environment for that kind of a question. You know, and so you're going to be a little bit more general. That's just the nature of it. But if you have questions, go to the doc underneath in the comment sections and say, this is an important question for me. So the next time we do one of these, we can actually potentially ask your question if it isn't ridiculous like Area 51, you know, Rex. There you go.
But, I don't but, you know. I think that's a pretty – I mean, we've been wondering that for years.
Yeah.
We could finally get some answers on Area 51.
But,
I think that'd be phenomenal.
We want we want our audience participation,
yeah.
And we're trying to do the best we can, but you got to help us do the best we can, or we're going to set up the questions and run, you know, and that's just the nature of it. So please get involved. That way you're not in chat being all frustrated because we didn't ask you your one pet question. Is that helping? Hopefully I don't sound like I'm being rude for that, but it's a lot of work to get to what we just did and participate beforehand, not afterhand. It's easy to criticize. Help us get there so we can be more effective for you as an audience. That's my
input. Also, what I'd like to add to that, Chris, is one thing I like about Blog Talk Radio and this kind of venue, especially with people calling in and chat participation and them adding questions on social media such as Facebook and, you know, I think after the election, you know, we'll be getting more on Twitter as well, you know, and other venues, you know. But what it is, it's all grassroots. And I think that's what is important to note, is that getting back to the grassroots, getting back to the people, I think that's what made the Tea Party so successful, at least, you know, until we found out that, you know, the candidates could have been, you know, vetted more, but that you live and learn. You know, but they were successful, I believe, in 2010. They really got out there. They were, you know, really well known. I mean, you couldn't turn on a TV any day without hearing something about the Tea Party. And I think something like that needs to happen again. And I think where it starts is venues such as this, and where we have the participation from the folks, you know, here in chat, what you've just talked about and Rex did. You know, and the different shows, but we've come into the shows and we find ourselves on Facebook. But then I think, and if you two gentlemen like to chime in on this or anyone else in the chat would like to call in or mention this in the chat, is that we, you know, you have this inside, you know, this area, okay? And I don't want to use the analogy of a church, but I'm sure folks who go to church hear this, where, okay, you take what you're hearing in a church, but now what's important is that you go out. And, you know, you get out of the office, so to speak, and you get out in the public and you do things. You inform people. You know, if people really like what they heard tonight about the Constitution Party, go to their website. They do have flyers that you could, now, of course, I believe you purchased them, but, hey, it's just like making a contribution to a political party, you know, in which you get the boots on the ground. It's very important for boots on the ground. You know, so do things of that nature. Instead, you know, it's very important, of course, to get the information from these shows instead of sitting in front of a TV and watching non-reality shows. You know, I mean, frankly, I'm not trying to offend anyone, but I think that's kind of a waste of time. I think time is much better well spent.
I'm
going like to
quit.
This, spending
you
time
insulted
on
me.
Your
group. No, I'm just kidding.
What was that?
I go, oh, I quit. You insulted me. I American Idol's my whole life. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Chris, I must say I know for a fact you have no time for American Idol.
Well,
and neither does Rex, for that matter.
Rex?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm being assaulted by rain, so I'm adjusting my position because I am outside.
I did put that video in chat of your ancestors, Rex, the Troglodytes.
Yeah, I did see that, and I do respect that very much. In fact, but I found out that the contagious behavior of the troglodyte really gets everybody fired up, and that's what I think Robert is talking about. It's great that you come here and you listen to candidates and that you find out their positions and you probe and investigate and see how it lines up with your views, and that's wonderful. It's good to be in Facebook groups and learn information. But the fact is that if all you're doing is figuring out who you yourself are going to vote for, we're not going to get anywhere. It's not going to get anywhere. You know, you need to figure out how you're going to get involved, what you're going to do actively to get people to understand that a non-conventional party vote is not a wasted vote. You've got, and look, it's going to be difficult. Some people are going to fight you on it. And the simple fact is that the true wasted vote is the vote that compromises your principles, especially when we all know for a fact, and we were talking about it for months leading up to the open convention, that Romney cannot win. So that's your wasted vote. So the real vote is to find, am I in line with the Libertarian Party and Gary Johnson? Am I in line with, you know, Ron Paul? Am I in line with Virgil Goode and Jim Clymer? And then take it a step further. If you're in line with them, and odds are, for the most part, you know, you're probably going to favor one over the other, but all three options, whether it's Ron Paul, conservative Libertarian Republican, or Virgil Goode, Constitution Party, or Gary Johnson, Libertarian Party, they're very similar in the sense that at least all of them respect the Constitution, which is precisely what Barack Obama and Mitt Romney don't do. And then the real answer is, okay, well, in my state, who has the best chance of victory? If you're in Texas, where you can write in a candidate, and he's an eligible write-in candidate, it's probably going to be a victory for Ron Paul. If you're in New Mexico, odds are it's Gary Johnson. I can assure you here in the Commonwealth of Virginia, it's Virgil Goode. Now, someone's going to be saying, well, you're splitting the vote. Well, no, you're really not splitting the vote. The splitting of the vote has already occurred when the Republican Party abdicated their authority by cheating to give us a liberal Democrat at the top of the ticket. So what's happening here is that the vote is already split. The question is, can you split the vote enough to prevent Barack Obama and Mitt Romney from getting 270 electors? And the answer is absolutely yes, but it will take work. So I think that the last two nights on Bart's Logic have been fantastic because, and I know everybody's got the one question that we didn't ask or the detail we didn't get. You know, it's 2 hours and 20 minutes of radio that we had. And, you know, like Chris said earlier, we're kind of amateurs at this, so I'm an amateur. There's some logistical problems, but I think we got some significant answers on fundamentals, on philosophy, on policy, and on who they are personally. I feel that you've got a picture. Now, whether you like the picture or not, that's up to you, but I think we got a pretty good picture. And then, of course, there are YouTube videos, articles, write-ups, stats, polls, all sorts of stuff that you can really use to dig into this information. And a lot of it is available, a massive amount of it is available to you on the Facebook page Coalition of Freedom. And I recommend you check it out there. Look in the document section. Chris has put together there a library that will take you days to get through. And it's like, oh, do I have to slog through all this stuff? Yes. Yes, you do. Because what we're talking about here is whether this will remain a republic, a confederation of sovereign states, or if we're going to truly have what is essentially a police state. Now, I'm not talking about the kind of police state that we see in the movies and, you know, future sci-fi zombie apocalypse or even, you know, Nazi Germany movies. It's the kind of police state that has just enough government force and a significant amount of cultural Marxism pressure, political correct pressure, to get you to go along, get along. Now, before you start going, oh, Rex is going on one of his tinfoil hat-wearing rants, okay, what do you think is happening with those people who are standing shoulder to shoulder with us, fighting tooth and nail, letting the world know that Mitt Romney is a flawed and terrible candidate who cannot win and doesn't stand up for our principles, all the way up through the Tampa convention, and then as soon as Romney stole the convention, they buckle. Now, you know, if you're weak and you buckle, you know, look, it happens. Every army has weak people, and, you know, they fall by the wayside, and you try to help them, but you move on to battle. But these people aren't just simply falling by the wayside. They are re-energized and coming after you and me to convince us to do exactly what all of us together said we would not do. When I said that I would never vote for Mitt Romney, that wasn't some kind of ploy so that my guy Newt Gingrich can win. That was a serious, unequivocal fact. It is a principled position that I chose to take, and I'm sticking to it. In fact, I'm doubling down on it because Romney didn't only not actually win the convention, which had he won it fairly, I might be able to consider taking a look at him. He stole it, validating everything that we said about him was true and then some. So these people coming after you hard now is the kind of pressure that you will experience in the society of the future with a one-party system whereby everybody will be spying on everybody and everybody will be giving that kind of social pressure for you to be a good citizen as opposed to a free, independent, sovereign American, which is your birthright. So I strongly recommend that you find out all of the information you need, formulate a decision. We're going to be working very hard in the future, not only to get you information about, like, I think Robert has some Gary Johnson people on tomorrow. We're going to have more Constitution Party people on in the future and hopefully some other candidates as well so that we can get to know what's really going on, the lay of the land. And we're going to try to develop a strategy as to which states has the best likelihood of which Liberty candidate winning. But then you've got to go take that message. And you've got to get it to people. You've got to reach out to your friends on Facebook. You've got to reach out to them by email. You've got to hand out, DVDs and CDs and pamphlets and direct people to websites and share information. And one of the easiest ways to do it is say, well, you know, when someone tells you, well, I'm really frightened of Barack Obama getting reelected, so I'm going to vote for Mitt Romney. So you ask them, well, what are Mitt Romney's chances of winning? They'll tell you he's, you know, slightly ahead in some polls, slightly behind in others. Yeah. But we don't vote by poll. We vote by state. And if you look at it as an electoral strategy, and Robert can mention the website that he's used before, Mitt Romney has no chance of getting enough electors. It's just so he's not going to win. The second question is, okay, well, even if he can win, you want to vote for him, ask them what's his tax policy. They don't know.
Yeah.
What's his economic policy? They don't know. What's his foreign policy? Oh, well, Barack Obama is appeasing people regarding the embassy burnings, and Mitt Romney was really strong about it. Yeah, come on. Mitt Romney's really strong about it the same day that he said half of the country are lazy bastards, the Hispanics are a problem, and women, you know, I mean, watch the video. The man told you the truth because that was unscripted, unedited, candid.
Yep.
And he basically told us the truth. He's one of the few politicians who was caught telling the truth. And the truth is he disdains you. He loathes you. Why would you vote for this guy? Do you think he's going to govern well on your behalf or on his corporate buddies? So, you know, there's a lot of work to do, and now is not the time to get discouraged or give up. I'm very excited. This is actually – I mean, look, I'd be far more excited for a brokered convention where Ron Paul and Newt Gingrich battled it out and Newt Gingrich won the – nomination, but that's gone, okay? But I'm excited about this because we're all getting back in touch with our roots. We're getting back in touch with the Constitution. We are learning how things actually work and how our process works, and we're getting involved and engaged, and we're bringing other people into it. And, you know, liberty is rising. as frightening as things are right now, or it looks like World War III is starting. We've got China and Japan ready to go to war. We got an armada in the waters around Iran. We got embassies burning all across the Middle East, and it's like, oh, my God, what's happening? Things are falling apart. This is the last gasp and the dying breath of the transnational globalists, because America is awake, and you are that awake American, and it's time for you to wake up your friends. And if they don't want to wake up, you wake them up anyway. And if they don't like you for it, tough shit. We have a country to save. Back to you guys.
Thank you, Rex. I really appreciate it. Yeah, I do have there's going to be some Johnson people coming on tomorrow, some Gary Johnson folks. And also on Sunday, I have Mr. Rod Class, who has a different perspective. He's also running for president, but he calls it the republic form of government. And one of the things he's going to talk about is the republic form of elections versus the democratic form of elections, which I think is going to be a very interesting conversation and something that I believe a lot of folks might, including myself, don't know a lot about. So it'll be very interesting to have him on this Sunday evening.
Awesome. Wow, Rex, you took all the words right out of my mouth. That was awesome, truly.
Or are you sharing your brain with me now? That's not good. That's bad.
Well, we have the same ancestors. you know, one of the things that when we started this journey was really, for me, it was personal. I just wanted to know. You know, I'm just a curious guy. I'm looking at my party going, you know, this whole primary going, we're in trouble. This party is crashing. It is going left, and it's going criminal, and it's going insane. I was just flabbergasted. It's the first primary I've ever followed day by day, you know, blow by blow, fact by fact, crime by crime, and it was very disheartening. I knew nothing about third parties. I'm like any other American, you know, listen to talk radio show, you know, was my feed for information. I've never been a real television person because I work all the time. So it was radio for me, and, you know, I had that programmed into my brain, we're a two-party country, and now I know why they program that into our brains, because they want all the power, and while they have the power, they want to abuse the power. What I heard tonight and last night, and we were real careful with Mr. Good, kept it light, kept it overview, philosophical, you know, we didn't want to dwell in and ask him, you know, how he was going to deal with the embassy, and, you know what I mean, that's not what that environment was for. But these two gentlemen, and including Floyd, and I have to put a shout out to him, because he's been tremendous in educating us behind the scenes on the party, plus he's come on shows, you know, which is in the archives. So here's the thing is I just learned a lot of stuff. I think I always knew, you know, but you don't hear it anymore. But I found it fascinating that a man and his vice president, even though they know they have a mess in Congress, will not abuse the same powers that are being abused by the people before them. I thought that was an interesting character point, and it was very powerful, because this is what our founding fathers wanted to do. And he made a point that's really key to our state sovereignty and authority, you know, program that we're doing, walking the journey of how this country was formed with Kelly Mordecai. Is the issue? He said it clear. I wanted to scream, but I didn't want to interrupt him and, you know, scare him. But you know, the thing he said: we states built the federal government. I think a lot of people don't understand, you know, the chicken before the egg or the egg before the chicken. That federal government didn't exist. The colonies exist. Most of them, not all of them, had their own constitution before the federal government was even formed. They made the federal government to operate as a function for them. A lot of it had to do with national defense, trade, you know, issues like that. And they never made it to rule over them. Boy, is that important for people to learn, understand, and get in your heart. Because if you get in your heart and you look at what's going on in our country, and you look at the candidates that we're told to vote for and attacked to vote for, and you look at that, you're going, that ain't what they made. That was not the original intent. In fact, there's a good book called Original Intent you can read, and you can learn some stuff. There's just so many resources. We are not the only resource on this. You've got to go out and fill the gray matter with the missing information, because they don't teach this crap in school anymore. Our Congress doesn't talk about it. I mean, think about it. What we just heard in two nights, this inspires me up so much. Have you heard one Republican in the last 10 years speak the things these two men spoke? Have you, Rex?
Have I heard the Republicans do what now? I mean, I've only heard them lie.
Speak the things that we just heard in the last two conversations about the Constitution and the rule of law and limited power and...
Well,
you don't,
I mean,
to this crap from
well,
anybody.
to their defense, I will say that some of them do speak about it.
They just
forget all about it when they get in office. Now, there are some, okay? There are some, and despite the Ron Paul people's feelings of betrayal of Rand Paul, I think Rand Paul is one. There are some guys in the House, true Tea Party elected in 2010, who were just completely overwhelmed by the power of Washington. And before all you go, why did they stand up? If you've never experienced something like moving into a place that has the stature and the power of Washington, Washington, D.C. was designed as a city that is supposed to intimidate. Because remember, when we were building our capital here, which was ostensibly swampland from Virginia, mm-hmm. from Maryland, and they built the city, they designed it to be intimidating because the United States was considered, basically a backwater remnant of a rebellious colony of Great Britain. So they wanted to exude power so that people would respect them. So when you go to Washington, it can be kind of intimidating. If you're a freshman congressman, as a Tea Party guy, which means you weren't a political animal, you were someone who just stood up, and Boehner and his people bring the full onslaught of the power of D.C. on you, it can be pretty powerful. So, their knees might be a little wobbly, but you give them some backup. You send
mm-hmm.
in a real constitutional
right.
executive, and some of those guys will stand up, okay? So it's very important that
I believe
we do
that.
It's very important that we do it. I agree, Chris. I think it's important we do it.
Yeah.
So,
gentlemen, speaking of talking, we only unfortunately have about 8 minutes left in the show, and that's got to leave out 5 minutes because I like to end with the closing song. But I'd like to... put out there for the new folks to Bard's Logic Political Talk. Something that I would appreciate is if you do like what you've been hearing and will like what we have to offer later on in some of the shows that you've heard Chris and I and Rex talk about will be coming up later, then please I ask that you can follow the show if you'd like, and it's easy to do. You just go to the homepage of Bard's Logic Political Talk, and under the icon you will see a little follow button. Just click that. And also, if you like what you're hearing tonight and also have been listening to Rex, he is also a host on the Tex and Rex show, which you can hear on Friday and Saturday evenings from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And if you like this show and you follow it, then I would pretty much think you would like that as well. So follow the Tex and Rex show also. So I will bring this back to, there's 7 minutes left, or as I said, about 4 minutes left, so I'll bring it back to you guys.
Well, Robert, thanks for promoting the Tex and Rex show. Tex and Rex I think you've figured out a little bit with me tonight when I'm not actually interviewing someone who might potentially be the next Vice President of the United States. A little irreverent, always relevant, and definitely radioactive conservatism with a bite. We're adding a new tagline this Friday, and that is that Tex and Rex is rhino-free radio. Rhino-free radio. And we will extend that umbrella to Bard's Logic Political Talk in Sammy Sanford, which comes up at 11, and you'll probably catch most of us characters on Sammy's at 11 tonight. But, Robert, I thought that... the interview today was great. It's wonderful that we had the chance to talk to the both of them, and I agree 100%
mm-hmm.
with Chris, who really did a good job with the questions. I agree 100%. Who talks about policy and statement and what are, quote, called gotcha questions, where they actually, I hit him pretty hard on the second time about executive orders because, here's my view, okay? Here's my view. My view is if a prior president used an executive order to create an extra constitutional power for himself, then I don't really see the necessity of going through Congress to roll that back. If you're not adding to it but actually taking it back to the Constitution, I think you can do that. However, Mr. Clymer took an extremely principled position, and he doubled down on it, and he said, we're going to govern according to the Constitution. So we are not going to exercise powers that the president does not have according to the Constitution, and we're going to go through Congress for legislative changes. That's pretty profound, okay? That's pretty profound. I mean, I still think my position is tenable, and I actually prefer it, but I like the fact that he took that principled position, and I'm okay with it. I think it's great. So, when do you get somebody who kind of talks to you about policy, about action, about experience and what they'll do, but then kind of gives you this wrapper? And like I told him, it felt like we were sitting around the campfire, having a beer, and talking about our founders and their vision of what this great nation should be, and the founding documents, and the natural law theories that are imbued in the Declaration of Independence, but that he would not govern according to natural law or even God's law, even though he himself obviously is a faithful Christian, that he is going to govern under the banner of the Constitution. In other words, he's saying, no matter how I feel, no matter what my view is, if you elect me to be your servant, which is essentially what the chief executive is, our servant, I'm going to bind myself in the chains of the Constitution and not act outside of it. That is profoundly refreshing.
Yeah, very powerful.
And I'd like to give Chris the last couple minutes. And I'd like to thank Chris for all of his hard work in getting the two gentlemen, both Jim Clymer and Virgil Goode, to Bard's Logic, and getting the interview questions together as well, and all the research. So thank you very much to you, Chris.
I appreciate it. I appreciate that, Robert. I'm just doing what I believe is right. One of the things that I want to say, because we've been on a Virgil Goode Constitutional Party pretty aggressively this last week, with interviews and radio shows and this and that and the other. But, to reiterate what Robert said earlier, that we are having the potentially, I think, at least the state chair of Virginia of the Libertarian Party, and possibly the vice chair. I've got to reconfirm. We kind of had this interview thrown at us pretty fast today. So today was supposed to be the Johnson prep interview. So I'll be doing that in the morning at dark 30. But, that we're going to dig in and give the can. I mean, Tom Hoefling had what, 6 radio shows done for him. So, we're trying to be fair across the board. So don't start calling us, Goode bots, because we've had a week of the Constitutional Party. We're doing our job, what we claimed we would do, and that's what we're on next. I'm in the process now of consolidating the information and getting my head, into the Johnson game, and, getting the policies and, what I'm saying, all that stuff together, so we can go at it and get it dealt with. And then people can figure out what the heck they want to do, and I'm going golfing after that, maybe climb a mountain or something, because it's been a lot of hours in this baby, right, Rex and Robert?
Yes, it is. On a daily basis. Well, I want to thank everyone who came in to listen to the show tonight, and also for those of you who have listened on the archive, thank you very much for coming in. And it's very important that you get this information. That's why we do all the work that Chris just described and Rex to get that information out there. And also what's important as well is to take the information that you do hear on these shows and on Chris's Facebook page, and bring it out, put it out to your to the folks that personally, friends, family, acquaintances, things of that nature, because it's important, for this country. And so I'd like to end it, as I do every evening, and at least kind of brings me down from all the excitement from the show, and that is the song from Aubrey Ashburn. And I want to say good night, everyone. Take care, and hope to see you again soon. Good night.